Moxie was out there too. Smoke in Griggsville. Smoke was sitting on a stool at the bar, and Rinaldo came to him. He'd beckoned the local from across the saloon, an exaggerated twirling of a finger, as though expressing that he, too, had an affinity for the magic outlaw, Moxie. Rinaldo had been shouting about the trick at Aberystone, and, much more important, about how the magician had been in Griggsville this very afternoon.
I'd just been thinking of the man. I was telling Liliana how much he's meant to me.
He had a few listeners, but none as keen as Smoke. The hired man sat alone at the bar, his elbows on the wood, and smiled as the small loudmouth paraded from table to table, drunkenly boasting of his encounter. Hardly any of the patrons believed Rinaldo, and those who did smiled politely. Smoke waited for another dip in interest, for the saloon to quiet, then signaled him over. Rinaldo, happy for the willing audience, went to him quickly.
Do I know you?
Not quite yet, but I sure as pigshit want to hear more of your story.
You appreciate James Moxie, then?
Me? I sure do. I do. One of the classiest outlaws the trail has ever known. You say you saw him today?
Rinaldo put his right hand in the air.
Not only do I say it, but I swear it.
Is that right?
Rinaldo smiled. He took the open stool beside Smoke.
I actually helped him a great deal.
Is that so? And what would a legend need from a man such as yourself?
Rinaldo smiled, proud.
I did nothing less than tell him he was in danger.
Fascinating.
Smoke ordered a beer for Rinaldo, water for himself.
Tell me more. What was James Moxie like?
Rinaldo's eyes widened.
James Moxie is a generous man.
How so?
He didn't have to honor me by speaking with me, but that's just what he did.
He stopped and carried on a whole conversation with you?
I had real information for him.
Like what?
Rinaldo considered.
I'm not so sure I should tell you that much, stranger.
The two men sipped their drinks.
Well, I sure wish I'd had a chance to see him,
Smoke said, shaking his head for the missed opportunity.
When did you see him?
This after.
What time?
Rinaldo considered.
3 hours passed, a few minutes less.
Smoke exaggeratedly snapped his fingers. Just missed him. Rinaldo leaned forward, wobbled, and almost fell off the stool.
I'll tell you a secret, sir. I'll tell you something very special to me.
Smoke set his water upon the bar and waited.
I was there,
Rinaldo whispered, loud.
In Aberystone.
Really?
Yes, indeed I was. I'm old enough to have been working at the time.
Smoke placed a hand upon Rinaldo's wrist.
Describe it for me.
Rinaldo was very willing to talk.
Just two men, sir, facing each other on Dunkel Street. James Moxie stood on one side, Daniel Proud's the other. Draw was called. A single shot was fired. Proud's chest blew open, but James Moxie never drew. I watched him close, and I wasn't the only one. He did not draw.
Smoke feigned disbelief.
Impossible.
Some say so, but those some are wrong.
What was the trick?
I don't know.
Surely you've got a theory.
I do.
And surely you asked, today.
I did.
But he didn't tell you, did he?
No, he did not.
What's your theory, then?
Rinaldo breathed deep.
His magic is real.
I see.
Rinaldo looked to the other patrons, then back to the stranger beside him. By the time Smoke's face was in focus again, Rinaldo started, for the friendly demeanor was gone. and in its stead was a seriousness Rinaldo did not like.
"Why don't you just tell me what you told him today?"
Rinaldo, blurry, attempted to end the conversation.
The important thing is,
why don't you just tell me what you told him today?
Rinaldo quickly took a sip of his beer. He knew bad men. He'd run letters for bad men for many years. There was a lack of depth in the eyes of bad men, as if they observed the world from well within their head, far from being able to feel for others. Smoke's face lit up with a smile. The friendliness was back.
"Well, it would sure make for a better story," Smoke said. "You see, James Moxie has always been something of a hero of mine. That man Prouds you mention was none other than the brother of a man who'd done awful things to my family and me. This is the true and truly. I've long meant to travel to Macatoon and thank the outlaw myself."
Rinaldo smiled. Smoke, it seemed, had spoken magic words. A fellow Moxie enthusiast indeed.
"You know he lives in Macatoon, then?"
"But of course."
Rinaldo looked around to make certain no one else could hear.
"Not many people do. That's where they sent the assassin, you see."
"The assassin?"
"Yes. There is a bad man after our friend Moxie. A man with a black heart and broken legs."
"I see."
Smoke sipped his water.
"And that's what you done told him today, that he's got a triggerman on his trail."
Rinaldo belched.
"I might have saved his life, one could say."
"You might have. You just might have."
Then flat silence between them. Rinaldo breathed heavy with booze. Smoke sat still as a spider.
"If you'll excuse me, sir,"
Rinaldo said,
"I've drunk more than my share celebrating, and I need to step outside."
In the glass behind the bar, Smoke watched Rinaldo exit the saloon. Giving Rinaldo enough time to enter the outhouse, Smoke rose and limped, navigating the web of Griggsville drunkards. Outside, the moon seemed to outline his body, trace the contours, stopping where the stubs of his knees met the cloth at the top of his tin shins. A drunkard in the shadows thought Smoke might be the angel of death, floating toward Rinaldo in the outhouse.
"Everybody's gotta use the shitter," he called. "Everybody's gotta go."
The black sky seemed to extend from Smoke's very mind, anger wide enough to dome the trail.
"It's a nasty shame to go this way,"
he called, not worried about witnesses. He'd burn them, too. For as slowly as he moved, Smoke acted fast. He took hold of a wood board from a pile beside the outhouse and jammed it hard under the black handle. He slipped his pointer fingers into the string loops in his pockets. Draw. A magic all Smoke's own. He felt the string pull along his thighs, heard the soft click of his boot heels opening. The oil came next. No windows on the box, the door secured. There was no exit for Rinaldo. Smoke sang.
"Oh, it's a pity, it's a patter, it's a pitter, to lose thy life on the shitter. Oh, it's a queer, it's a quail, it's a quitter, who falls down dead on the shitter."
The tavern's back door opened, and a man stumbled out, and Smoke turned to him, and the man saw him, and stumbled back inside. Smoke pulled a matchbook from the chest pocket of his shirt. A flame quickly came to life between his dirty fingers. He limped to the door, a silhouette on half stilts, and pressed his forehead against the wood.
"You think it smells bad in there now, hogsucker? Just wait. You're gonna be your own legend after this one, just like your man. A hog-blessed legend of the trail."
He pushed off from the door. He dropped the match. The outhouse went up fast. Smoke did not wait to watch it ash. But he watched for as long as he could, knowing that sometimes the pride one takes in one's work is better for the job than any pace or progress can ever be. Halfway through the burning, Smoke limped toward the saloon, his horse, and the outlaw, who now knew he was not alone on the trail. Moxie by the Fire. Night of the first day had come. Moxie knew he was exactly half the distance to Harrow's. He didn't want to stop. He didn't want to have to stop, but the horse was breathing heavy, and Moxie knew that, in the end, a rested horse would get him there faster. The sky was already black, and the stars were uncountable. The pines had gone from green to gray, and now even their tops were difficult to see. Many years had passed since Moxie last watched the sun go down so slowly, in this way, the gradation in step with his travel north, the trail turned black. The horse moved slowly during the summer sun's descent, and when Moxie saw the first vestige of illumination ahead, moonlight at last, he felt relief, the rest somehow indicating that the ride tomorrow had already begun. He jerked the reins, and the mare pulled up lethargic. Moxie dismounted, untied the bedding, and laid out a blanket for himself. He walked the horse to a solid pine near the blanket's edge and soothed her, rubbing her mane. There was still plenty of water and feed. After caring for her, he set to finding himself some wood. In the dark, he thought. Carol, a day closer now, felt infinitely far. The reality of her was something from his youth. Riding to her was something like riding to the breakfast table he shared with his mother and father as a child. Gathering wood in the dark, Moxie questioned what he was truly doing. Can a man set right his past? With these questions came the possible futility of the ride and the hopelessness of absolution. The guilt was unbearable. With an armful of sticks and smaller logs, he stomped through the dark back to camp. He made a small fire near the blanket, and the horse stood silent. It was a good fire, and it felt good, and Moxie hadn't realized how cold he had gotten until he was sitting, warming his hands. He studied the mare, the way the flames altered her features, changing her eyes from white to black and back again. The way she looked into the darkness beyond the fire. Moxie thought of Carol. Carol on her back, arms folded, sleeping. Decades ago, Moxie was plagued with nightmares that resembled these thoughts. Horrible visions of her death recurring. Carol, young, floating in the bathtub, her skin pruned by the time he found her, her body bloated, waterlogged, stiff. In those days, he worried about leaving her for even an hour, lest he return to find she had collapsed into a fire like this one. But the worst was the dream in which Carol was already buried, muffled screams from the earth, the scratching of her nails against the wood, her grave bell echoing through the graveyard. Moxie would rush in these dreams, breaking apart the dirt with his hands, an unfair race with the oxygen left in her box. Even now, looking into the fire, he could hear her voice, pleading, getting weaker as he dug 3 feet, 6 feet, 9 feet, 20 feet, until the sun was blocked by the height of the grave, and the sky was a pale blue square at the end of a tunnel going up, up, a square from which insane laughter escaped, a tiny, impossible place to be, Carol's salvation out of reach, out of air. The horse neighed, and Moxie looked up into the darkness. Fires were good for the warmth, but fires also created black worlds beyond the range of the flames. Moxie rubbed his hands together and saw the shape of Carol in the rising smoke, sleeping, not dead. "We have another long ride tomorrow," he said. The horse looked to him, and then into the darkness of the woods again. Moxie spread the corners of the blanket and lay down. He slept briefly. And when he woke, he saw a man seated on the other side of the fire. It was very dark, but the fire was still burning. Brighter, Moxie realized, than it had been when he'd fallen asleep. A foreign crackling sound, as though something not from the trail, was burning in there. He did not rise. He stared at the figure, seated, a pair of wide eyes focused on the fire, and a face seen in pieces as the flames would let him. "I know that you are awake," the man said. Moxie knew it was the voice from the barber shop, the voice from a tavern in Portsooth many years ago. He made to rise, but the voice stopped him. "You don't want to see me. Not yet." It breathed, an audible wheeze, black wind across a gravel sky. "Who are you?" Moxie asked. The flames split for the duration of a heartbeat, a fraction of that, and Moxie saw the eyes again, large and unfocused, darting from the fire to the ground beside it.
You must really want to know this. You ask every time.
Then the eyes connected with Moxie's own, and the flames came together to block the view once more. But Moxie had seen enough of the face, the rippling features, the exchange of faces, as if one had been painted upon another with grease.
I want you to turn back,
the thing said. Moxie was silent.
There was a time, the right time, for you to be doing what you're doing. But that time has passed.
Moxie was silent.
There's no reason to let it propel you, it said. All men have regrets.
She's not dead,
Moxie finally said. Fingers of flame suddenly reached for him, and Moxie hurried back in the dirt. He heard a hissing, water boiling, an egg under the sun.
She's dead.
Moxie got up and the fire rose with him, blocking the face on the other side. The mare breathed heavy, but did not wake.
You don't want to see this face. Not yet.
Clouds obscured the moon and the fire crackled sharp. A wind came then, whirling the embers up in a circle around the fire and making the flames rise even higher. In them, Moxie saw the eyes again, the form, seated, but suspended, perhaps above the dirt.
Have you considered that she does not want you to come?
No.
But he had.
Have you considered that she is already rotting?
No.
But he had.
Have you considered that the people in her life now will laugh at you when you arrive? That they will turn you back as I do now, sending you on your chivalrous way?
I'm not interested in her people.
No, you're not.
Moxie heard movement to his right and turned quick. A man emerged from the blackness. Moxie recognized him at once.
I told you she was dead once already, James.
Moxie remembered this man. His face, his voice, even the clothes he wore, the derby hat, the necktie, the rolled-up blue sleeves, the leather case in one hand. This man was a doctor once, lifetimes ago. The man he'd brought Carol to the first time he thought she had died.
She's not, Moxie said.
I told you she was dead once already.
Deep breathing from across the fire. The doctor's eyes swelled, grew, until they popped, and the flaked pieces of his eyeballs sizzled in the flames. Moxie backed up fast.
You were wrong, doctor.
Was I?
The doctor, eyeless, gripped his bag.
Dead to you, anyway, the way you left her.
Moxie stared into the caverns above the doctor's nose, saw Carol on her back in the wrinkles of one, himself walking away from her in the other.
As I recall,
the doctor continued,
you had little difficulty ignoring her once. Why the change of heart?
Another flame reached for Moxie's boot. He stepped aside.
She's not dead.
Yes,
the doctor said.
She is. It doesn't take a medicine man to smell her now.
The doctor's mouth swung open, a tongue unraveled, fell hard to the dirt, and rolled toward Moxie. Moxie steeled himself. Then it was only the doctor again. The doctor as he'd looked some 20 years ago. His eyes were intact again, the same eyes that had looked into Moxie's own long ago, explaining Carol's condition.
Let me show you something, he said now.
I don't want to see it.
Yes, you do.
The shape on the other side of the fire continued to breathe, hoarse, steady, slow. The doctor knelt in the dirt and opened his black bag. From it, he removed something large, shapeless, dripping.
This, James, is her stomach. I've removed it to determine her cause of death. And here?
He knelt again and came up with more of her.
These are her lungs. Now, James, you know a lady can't breathe without her lungs, don't you?
Moxie fingered the pistol in his right holster.
You were wrong, doctor.
The doctor stepped forward, his face changing again, a ram's head upon his shoulders.
You will suffer like her if you continue to ride.
Moxie drew his gun and fired. Through the smoke of the shot, the doctor appeared, whole, himself again.
"You see," the doctor said, "you've made me mad."
The breathing from the other side of the fire became wind, and the doctor blew apart, his pieces floating as the embers had moments ago. Moxie turned to face the thing from the tavern in Portsooth, the impossibility whose face was not fixed.
"Please, sit."
"I'll stand."
"You'll sit."
Against his will, Moxie fell to the dirt.
"I will tell you this once more, James Moxie. Turn back now. Go home. Blood no longer flows through the veins of the woman. You ride for a corpse, James Moxie. There is no meaning in your journey. There is no journey. You cannot rid yourself of the guilt for having left her once, for having turned your back on her then. All you can do now is repeat your choices, reenact the spineless steps of your youth. Do you remember them? Here, I have given you the footprints to follow."
Moxie saw fresh prints appear in the dirt by the fire.
"Your boots have not changed since then. You will recognize the shape of your own steps, walking away from the very thing you rush to now. Here, I have given you the same weather."
Moxie shuddered as the wind turned to ice.
"The same air that coddled a mind that once decided wisely. Do you sense it? Can you feel the same day upon you? Your face has changed, but the bones beneath it have not. Here, I give you the same food in your belly. Do you feel it? Yes, I can see you do. Nothing has changed, but the skin upon your body is slack. Nothing has changed, but the color in your eyes has gone gray. Here, I give you the footprints, the air, the food, and the sounds, too. Do you hear? Can you hear her sobbing for your exit?"
Shivering, Moxie felt the sudden food in his belly, and as he shook his head no, the water in his eyes began to freeze.
"Can you hear the woman weeping for the man who turned his back once and will do so again? The thing you try to change is not the noble thing you think it is. The thing you seek is immovable, unchangeable, dead. Guilt cannot be overcome. Only endured. Turn back now, and you will make worthy your decision then, for it will still be true. The woman is dead. Do you see the path? Do you see the prince? Yes. You know the steps well. I imagine they look different from the ones you remember, the ones that replay in your sleepless slumber. They look different from the ones you try to avoid when you walk the dirt roads of your memory. They look different not because they are, but because you remember them wrong. You remember them as smaller than they were, someone else's steps, the decision of a younger man. But that younger man is you, and these are your prints. You have altered them to fit the bottom of boots you can live with, a size you no longer recognize. Someone else's choice. Here, I give you the boots. Try them on. Tell me they do not fit. They do. James Moxie, they do."
The fire rose higher than the trees, melting the ice in the sky. Moxie saw old boots in the flames, red boots, wet with snow.
"The only choice you have," Rot said, "is to convince yourself there was never anything to feel guilty for, to begin with."
Moxie, still on his back, looked to the prints in the dirt by the fire's edge, and felt too much of everything. All of it at once. His bones ached. His body was bloated. The voice continued, twisting his mind in braids. But Moxie rose to his knees. Rot laughed. Black wings taking flight, the rhythm of hammers driving nails into a casket. Moxie tried but could not stand. Rot laughed, and the cacination dug into Moxie's ears as the worms would soon dig into Carol's. Soon. 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 On his knees beside the fire, Moxie believed he was going to die. His day's ride was a journey to death, to die alone, here in these trail woods. With Carol, she of so many deaths, on his mind. He closed his eyes, and he cried. And when he opened them again, the feeling was gone. His body was not bloated. He did not shiver from cold. Slowly, Moxie rose and looked through the flames and saw no one was there. The shape, the thing, rot was gone. He stepped cautiously around the fire, guns drawn, and saw only sticks, no trace of the fiend, the voice that exhumed his mistakes, the words that burned bold in his brain. But the prints of his past remained. Moxie eased himself carefully down to the ground and lay back on the blanket, still gripping both guns, his eyes fixed on the stars. His body hurt from riding. His body hurt from the guilt. He lay this way a long time, thinking of Carol, ignoring every cracked stick in the dark wood, every fallen leaf on this side of the trail. He thought of Carol and of the black-haired, green-eyed girl Molly, too, as she beckoned him, asked him to come. Come on, come meet my friend Carol. Molly's gesture is innocent then, as it was today, in the glass of a barber shop in Baker. Come meet my friend Carol. You're going to love her, my friend. You're going to love Carol. Carol and Moxie. Memories more like nightmares, and dreams like true visions, scattered, fallen from a shelf, out of order, or maybe proof that the order never mattered to begin with.
It's its own condition, the second doctor said. It's very different from a coma.
This doctor knew better than the first, but Carol already knew all this. Only she was in a coma and couldn't tell James what she should have told him already. When she woke, she did.
I die. Many times I die.
She was on a cot in the doctor's home. Moxie sat in a chair beside her. How often does it happen?
There is no pattern. But I heard you in there, James. I heard you carrying me to the first doctor's, and now here.
I was scared, Carol.
I know.
Eventually, the doctor joined them.
In the coma, Carol, your pulse beat slow enough that, had I not held my finger longer than I normally would, I wouldn't have known it existed. Your flesh has color, but you do not stir, and even your breathing was very difficult to detect. I don't entirely blame the last doctor for what he told James. I might have thought you were dead myself.
Carol took Moxie's hand.
I should have told you.
Why didn't you?
I was worried it would scare you away. Come on,
the girl was saying.
Come meet my friend. Meet my friend Carol.
Moxie was a young man, but this wasn't the first tavern he'd been in. It was just the most fun.
Come on. She's over here. Her name is Carol. You're going to fall in love with her.
He'd been standing against the wall, holding his glass, grinning with the other young men and women, listening to the musicians playing on stage. He'd already had enough whiskey to know he was drunk, and the dark-haired girl, beckoning him, made him nervous.
What are you saying?
But she couldn't hear him over the music, and Moxie pointed at himself, questioning.
Me?
Come on,
she said, waving, smiling.
Come on!
Moxie adjusted his hat and followed the girl through the bodies. She crossed the bar to the other side where the boys played guitars or piano, beat hand drums, and screamed rather than sang. Moxie spilled some of his drink on his shirt on the walk, and by the time he caught up, he was wiping it down with his hand. The dark-haired girl turned her full face to him and pointed to another girl standing against the wall, light brown hair, smart eyes, sweating there, too, like the rest of them.
Not like this,
Moxie said, answering whether or not he'd experienced such a kiss before. Carol smiled. There was something extra innocent about this man. It was as if he couldn't help but speak what he thought.
Well, I'm glad to hear it,
she said, running her fingers through his black hair. She kissed him again, and Moxie, moving on instinct and doing what he wanted to do, took her face in his hands and kissed her back. They sat this way, the blue moonlight coming through the crack in the barn doors, washing them, a long time.
Mother doesn't like the name Howltown, never has, she said. She just calls it That Place, but that title frightens me more.
It's too close to the truth, for that place is certainly not this one.
Don't worry, Carol said, smiling, turning to him as the snow fell in her hair.
Hattie's going to like you. Why wouldn't she? I do.
Moxie followed her out of the coach and walked with her up the long drive to her mother's house. Hattie, Carol said, was something of an inventor, spent all her time tinkering, always planning, always building.
You're bound to see gears and levers all over the workroom floor. Ignore them if you want to, or don't. Ask her about them. Maybe she'll even tell you about the box.
The box? Carol smiled.
Like I said, she's always tinkering with something new.
The ground was frosted, but the air was warm, the snowfall having broken the spell. He held the gate for Carol and didn't see as her mother peered out through the front window. When they reached the door, Hattie opened it and Moxie was introduced. They stepped inside and Hattie said,
"Why, you look like a gentleman outlaw if I ever saw one."
But she didn't show James the workroom, asked Carol not to bring it up again.
"Silas!"
Moxie screamed, pounding the door again.
"Silas! Open the door! She's dead, Silas! Carol's dead!"
They were buying her a hat the first time she collapsed in front of him. Carol was at the mirror, angling her head, and Moxie was telling her they all looked good, because they did. She made him try on ladies' hats and laughed as he imitated her mother. The salesman shooed him away and brought Carol a pile of fresh ones. She said,
"Ooh, that one looks good."
Then she fell. "Not like this," Moxie said, answering Silas, who had asked him if he'd ever felt this way before.
"Well, you're in for a lifetime of work, I'm afraid. Love isn't easy."
"Love?" The pair sat behind a barn, their backs to the wood.
"Do you like her smell?"
"I do."
"Do you like her walk?"
Moxie blushed.
"I do." "Does she look as soft as the lamb's wool to you?"
"She does, Silas."
"You love her, then."
"I love her."
"She's dead,"
the first doctor said, setting her wrist back on the table. Moxie, sweating, raging, looked like the man he would one day become.
"You're wrong, doctor. I felt her heart beating. As I carried her here, I felt a beat."
The doctor, his face serious beneath a derby hat, removed his glasses and hooked them in his vest pocket. His blue shirt sleeves were rolled up to the elbows.
"A beat? Just one?"
"Isn't one enough?" The doctor frowned.
"Maybe you did feel a beat," he said, "but it isn't beating anymore."
"Where else can I take her?" Moxie asked.
"I'm afraid any professional is going to tell you the same thing. When a person is dead, they're dead, no matter who looks at her."
On the table, Carol looked like someone had stolen something from her while she was sleeping, but not everything.
"You're wrong, doctor."
He put Silas's coat over her and slid his arms under her neck and knees and carried her out the door. Silas ran to the door and saw his friend soaked outside. Carol was limp, leaning against him.
"What is it, James?"
"She's dead, Silas. She just suddenly fell."
Silas told him the name of a doctor, told him how to get to his house.
"Wait,"
Silas said as Moxie turned to go. He ran back inside and came out with a coat he laid over her body, supported there in Moxie's arms.
"My name is Carol," Carol said, extending her hand. "I see my friend dragged you to me."
Moxie smiled and reached his hand out and then pulled it back and wiped it on his pants, realizing there was whiskey on it.
"I love you," Carol said.
"I love you, Carol."
"You do."
"I do."
Carol rose from the kitchen table.
"If we're going to do this, you're going to have to live with my dying."
Moxie swallowed hard.
"I get it. I will. You understand."
But she could tell he was scared.
"It's its own condition," the second doctor said, standing over Carol's stiff body.
It's something like a seizure, but very different. I've read of it, but I hadn't expected I'd ever run into it.
She's alive, then?
Oh, no question. Her heart beats. You felt it yourself.
Moxie was dripping water on the examination room floor. Silas's coat hung on the back of a chair. The doctor rubbed his eyes, and Moxie could tell the man was a good man.
How long will she sleep?
The doctor thought about it.
I honestly don't know. Like I said, I've never seen it in person before. I don't imagine many of us have. My worry is that she will not receive the proper nourishment for the duration of her spell. How long can a person exist under such circumstances? I've no idea. We need to watch her. We need to feed her through needles, tubes, and I cannot guarantee her current position will improve any.
But it did. Carol woke the next day.
Can you imagine if they would have buried you?
But Carol had stopped thinking about burials long ago. They walked in silence. Then James said,
"You know, this makes you special, like a ghost."
Carol had heard something like that before. Another doctor called her reborn when she was just a girl. Hattie got angry when the doctor said that, told the doctor that nobody could be reborn unless they died first.
"But didn't I?"
Carol had asked. Hattie turned on her, eyes cold as river water.
"Not on my watch, Carol."
"Do this," she said, turning to him in the kitchen. "Catch me a blue owlfly. I know, you're a big man, but do it. Catch me an owlfly and bring it to my door, and I'll know you're ready. I'll know what it means. Catch a blue owlfly, put her in a jar, and leave it at my door if you want to. You don't even have to knock. Just set it on the sill. I'll see it, and I'll know you're ready."
"I suppose it is a lot to handle," Silas said, leaning back against the barn. "But not much more than a man has to handle anyway."
Moxie was quiet.
"Think of it this way," Silas said. "You've already gone through it 3 times.
Moxie nodded, but did not speak. The vacancy in his friend's eyes frightened Silas.
"Have you considered," Silas said, "that the only reason you'd walk away is that you'd care about her? Have you? Because that's what it is, James. You don't want to have to see her that way again."
"My name is Moxie."
"Moxie? That's a queer one."
"Well," he blushed and removed his hat, "my name is James Moxie."
"I like it. Do you like this song, James Moxie?"
Moxie looked over his shoulder at the band. He smiled.
"I do."
It went like this.
"Oh, we'll have fun when our folks hit the trail, when our horses sleep from the beer and the bale, when our enemies die and the grudges they carried, and we'll keep on dancing long after they're buried."
"Physically, she's very close to dead, but her mind continues. She says she's not thirsty or hungry in there, and also, I find this fascinating. She described it as one continuous fall. I told her that sounded frightening. She told me that depended on how often you fall."
The doctor, clearly charged by the events, spoke as Carol rested, awake, in another room. Moxie just wanted to know when it would happen again.
"I can't say. And because of that, it's important you take very good care of her. It's important you watch her. Say she was crossing the road, a coach approaches. It would be a terrible thing if she were alone, say, if she were to fall."
Moxie carried the package under one arm. He walked steady, but his heart beat hard. Silas was right. The doctors were right. Carol was right. But he couldn't do it. Carol's house was just a fence length away, but there he turned back. The air was icy, winter on the trail. Moxie's red boots left heavy prints in the snowy dirt. He felt something like an entirely open life before him, a life in which he didn't have to worry that his lady might slip into false death with every syllable of laughter that escaped her lips, a life without keeping watch of Carol every minute, every hour, every day.
Had he seen her house, it would have been the last time he saw it. But he didn't walk quite that far. Years later, he wouldn't be able to remember exactly when it was, the last time he'd seen her house. Or her person. His boots dug into the snowy gravel of the trail, and the package felt oily and snake-like under his arm. He ought to drop it, he thought. He ought to drop it on a rock. Or maybe he should just tuck it behind a tree and cover it with leaves, and if she ever chanced upon it, she might smile, something to warm the cold he was going to leave her with. He did neither, carrying the jarred owlfly home with him instead. How many times had she died now? How many times had he believed it was real death, this time? 5? 6? And with each one, Moxie held his own breath lest this be the time she slipped too far, slept too long, her false cadaver just a room away, him there at the window, looking out at all the infinity of a wide-open, carefree life. He entered his home and set the jar on the table. He took the paper off it, and when he did, the dying sunlight came through the oily wings of the blue owlfly within, painting the other side of the glass with its color. Moxie covered it again and began packing. The decision to leave Carol had shaken his reality, his identity, in many ways. Staying put was now impossible. When a man turns his back on one thing, he must then be facing another. The trail waited. Moxie, a single green sack packed with his scant belongings, took to it.
"I'd have thought she was dead myself," the second doctor said. "Could have fooled a coroner, I'd say. Could have fooled a coroner, a funeral director, and a coffin maker all at once. Could have fooled a whole town, unable to hear the bell because she couldn't ring it. A whole town grieving the loss of a living woman. That bell positioned useless above her grave. The string an inch from a hand that just didn't have the power to pull it."
Manders visits Sheriff Opal. Opal was sleeping deep when the knocking came. The Sheriff of Harrow's lived a rather routine life. He left the office every day when the sun went down, and he returned just as it came up. Sometimes it was necessary he stick around, and so he might. Sometimes he wanted to keep his eye on things, but most commonly, Opal tipped his hat to the ladies he passed, minding the men and the boys. And no matter what time he left, he stopped off in Eleanor Roberts's kitchen in the Corey Hotel and took with him a sack full of steak to eat on his horse ride home. If you lived in Harrow's and did nothing wrong, you might not know the law existed. The sheriff was one for keeping the peace and had no mind to meddle, no mind to push himself on the people who elected him. But if you did do something wrong... It wasn't the first time he woke in the middle of the night to the sound of knocking. Often it was Deputy Cole asking advice, informing Opal of a fight that had ended badly. Usually Opal would be kind with the deputy, either instructing him how to fix things or telling him he needn't really have come all this way for the matter.
"Shutters," he said, sitting up in bed. "I'm coming."
The knock came again. It was light, too graceful to be Cole with urgent news. Opal didn't like to guess, but he thought it might be a newcomer looking for protection, a harmless beef to do with new neighbors. The sheriff grabbed his gun off his night table and headed up the hall. He walked slow, having heard enough horror stories of fool sheriffs gunned down at the threshold of their own front doors.
"Who goes there?"
Opal called, one hand on the knob, the other holding the gun chest high.
"It's Robert Manders, Sheriff Opal."
Opal frowned. A funeral director knocking at night was a curious thing indeed. He lowered his gun and opened the door.
"What's the matter, Manders? You got ghouls?"
The director tried to be cordial, but Opal could tell he was concerned.
"Come in,"
Opal said, stepping aside.
"We'll talk in the kitchen."
Manders followed the sheriff to a small white table adorned with a single candle. Opal lit it and sat down, fanning his hand to the other seat, asking the director to do the same. Manders did.
"I feel strange having come here."
"I think so. If it was anything other than strange that you come here for, I might think you strange myself."
"It's true.
I wouldn't wake you without something worth waking you for.
What is it, Manders?
It's Carol Evers, Sheriff.
All right. What about her?
She passed yestereve.
I was at the wake.
And Mr. Evers visited with me.
To set things up?
Well, not everything. Mr. Evers has hired someone else to dress the body.
Someone from out of town? Family?
That's what he said. Family. Do you know them?
I do not.
Manders hesitated before asking.
How about a Dr. Alexander Wolfe? Have you heard of him?
I have not.
It's the name of the doctor who determined Carol Evers's cause of death.
All right.
Well, Sheriff Opal, that's the part that concerns me. I'm most likely out of line in saying so, but I couldn't help feeling things were out of sorts when I talked to Mr. Evers.
How's that?
I couldn't get a clean line on what he was telling me, and the note he gave me from this Dr. Wolfe was, well, truth be told, suspicious.
That's a big word in my dictionary, Manders.
I imagine it is.
Go on.
I checked the ledger of registry tonight in my office and found absolutely no trace of any doctor named Alexander Wolfe.
Opal studied Manders closely. In the flickering candle, the funeral director looked like a child's drawing of concerned.
How reliable is this book?
The registry?
The registry.
Well, it's important I'm up to date on these matters. I have the current edition. I think it goes back no later than a year.
He could have gotten cleared in that year?
Yes.
And what area does the book cover?
A fair-sized stretch of land. I'd gather almost every town you've ever been to is in this book, most of the trail.
Where'd Evers say he was from? Did he?
Yes. He said he was from Charles.
Is that it?
Well, there's that and the note.
The doctor's note?
The doctor's note.
From an Alexander Wolfe?
I don't think in my entire life I've read a less professional account.
Do you have that note on you?
I do not. I gave it back to Mr. Evers.
And what did it say, then?
Oh, it employed correct language, I suppose, but there was really no conclusion, and it lacked any sense of studied jargon.
Opal didn't like what he was hearing. Manders was a man he took seriously.
Are you suggesting he made him up?
Yes, I think I am.
Opal sat silent half a minute.
Don't hold hands with your thoughts yet, Manders. Not thoughts like those. Way too many possibilities to start thinking yours is the right one. Could be the doctor isn't legit. Hell's heaven. I got friends who prefer witch doctors. Things get real drafty when you start opening windows on a person's preferences.
But the doctor couldn't be from too far out of town.
That's right.
Because he saw her soon after she died.
That's right. But just because he has to be from around here and isn't in your book doesn't mean he doesn't exist. You ever known Mr. Evers to get sick?
I'm sure he has.
Well, me too, but I don't know who he saw to get his runny nose plugged, and I don't know who he'd go to for his wife's passing.
I understand.
Is that it?
Yes, Sheriff. I think that's it. Though I might add Mr. Evers seemed desirous of getting Carol into the ground as soon as possible.
How's that?
He asked that the burial take place this very morning. I told him it could not. Not with the illness probably just leaving Harrow's now.
But the wake was today.
I suppose he meant directly following.
Opal studied Manders' eyes specifically. No one in Harrow's handled as much death as the funeral director, and information from Manders had helped solve more than one case. Yet Dwight Evers never struck Opal as someone to worry about.
So then, is that it?
Well, Lucas and Hank tell me Mr. Evers is keeping Carol in the cellar.
What does that mean?
I don't know, but it seems a curious place to keep a lady.
How do they know this?
They heard it from Clyde Darrow, Sheriff, who heard it from his wife, Carol's girl, Farrah.
Opal exhaled long and looked into the flame.
The funeral is the next morning after?
Yes, it is.
At your place?
Yes. I had the plot dug this evening.
Okay.
Opal ran his fingers through his hair once and got up.
You understand by your coming here tonight, you're accusing a man of suspicious behavior.
I do, though I hope nobody has to hear of my coming.
I just might need you later is all. I'll look into it, I will. But it's almost too bright to be anything foul. Those sorts of things usually hide themselves better. My advice to you is to carry on with your business as you would, and let me do the looking.
Opal saw Manders out and thanked him for coming. He locked the door and walked back to his bedroom. In bed, he closed his eyes and thought it was a strange thing for a man with so many bedrooms to keep his dead wife in the cellar, even if only for a short spell. It was weird, is what it was. Like maybe the only reason a man would do such a thing was because he didn't want anybody to see her the way she was. He's hiding her. But Opal knew better than to jump to conclusions. He considered getting back out of bed and riding over to the Evers' home. A lot of adjusting could be carried out in one night. He didn't like that the funeral director felt compelled to come out, got dressed and rode all the way out here. Opal sat up once, and then lay down again.
Tomorrow, he told himself. Tomorrow.
But it wasn't a confident directive, and the three syllables troubled him as he slept. Smoke sleeps too. When he limped, stiff-legged, into the body house, the girl thought she'd just tell him it was too late at night for a customer. The last thing on earth she wanted to deal with was a pity case, and she knew the girls didn't love doing the cripples. There was something extra pathetic about this one, like the man was too broken even for a place this foul. But it was that late hour when the place still rollicked, the moment just before the fun would crack in half, and she silently cursed the man for not showing 20 minutes later. Then it would have been easy. Then she could have fanned her hand out to the 2 dozen men and women passed out on the couches, the floors, the piano, and he would have seen for himself the night was over. But he hadn't, and here he was. And he didn't look like he could even make it up the stairs, let alone climb atop one of the girls. But the closer he got, the more the girl guessed this wasn't his first time in a house of ill repute. Something unnerving about this one. Maybe it was the lack of a hat, or the fact that only half his hair was cut.
Kind of a late-night decision, eh?
Smoke, who had been observing the jolly rancor, looked at her now.
It's always late at night in a place like this.
She didn't like the way he spoke, the way he looked at her as he spoke. She reacted fast, attempting to establish a tough veneer, a thing she was used to.
Did it take a while to get up the nerve, or did you just find yourself bored?
He didn't answer, only looked around a little more. The girl decided no, she didn't feel good about him at all, but she didn't show it.
You'd like to see the girls, then?
Smoke put his elbows on the counter.
No. No.
No, ma'am.
You want a drink?
I'm working right now.
If you're just looking for a place to sleep.
Smoke lit up, a smile, ghastly as a smashed plum.
That's it,
he said, and the girl thought she smelled oil on his breath.
A place to sleep. Here's what I'd like. I'd like a room, one of the rooms you'd give a man with a girl, but I don't want the girl, all right?
The girl tried to remain polite. She knew what to do with the rough ones. But this one hadn't gotten rough yet.
There's a hotel, she said, just up Howard Street.
Smoke looked at her without expression.
Understand, she said. It'd be unusual for me to just rent out a room. Then let's be unusual. Let's be downright weird.
Wild piano chords clanged from the adjacent room. Girls giggled.
You mind my asking why you'd pick a place like this to get some peaceful sleep? I never said I was looking for peace.
The girl felt a strong urge to fetch the madam, and almost did, but recently she'd been scolded for calling when she could have handled the situation herself.
You get my attention when it's an emergency, Susan, and you do it yourself when it's not.
Was this an emergency? Hardly. Not yet, she thought. But the man talked crazier than he walked.
I'm not sure there are any rooms available.
Her voice betrayed her blossoming unease. Smoke looked at the girl for a long time. She could tell he was thinking, and all she could think was that he was thinking whether or not to kill her. And he smelled, yes, he definitely smelled of oil.
Hell's heaven, he finally said, his face calm, too calm. Here's what we'll do. You'll go and set me up a room where I'm alone for the night, and I won't burn this pig-shit palace down. You go and clear a room out for me, and I won't torture you. You like your face? Sure you do. I do, too. I like your face. It's a fine face. Do your fine face a favor and go along. Make room for me. Get me the dirtiest mattress in this place if it needs be. But be quick about it. My legs hurt. My legs always hurt, but they hurt more than usual now. And if you go and get me that room, I'll let you all continue to make merry. Hell, I'll let you live. You want to live, don't you?
He glowered.
Get me a room, girl, and I won't sear the flesh from your bones.
Smoke snapped his fingers, and a small flame appeared at the head of a match, and the girl let out a little scream. An hour later, the sounds from below considerably quieter. Smoke sat on a fold-out wooden chair and stared into the darkness of a rotten room. He thought of the lawman who had stopped him at the head of town. He thought of how the officer didn't laugh when he told him his name was James Moxie, but then told him he wasn't the first. Not the first what? Smoke had asked him. Not even the first one today. Smoke smiled. I'll tell you what, Smoke said, suddenly taking the lawman by surprise. I'm going to go to that there cat house right there and spend the night. I may bed one of the girls and I may not. But either way, that's where I'll be and that's the only place I'll be. The officer said something about himself being the one to make the rules here, and Smoke said, go on then, make the rules. Then the lawman told him that he'd better go straight to that cat house and do whatever he was going to do and get out by sunup. Smoke smiled. He hated towns like this one. He thanked the officer and passed, and the officer asked him what was wrong with his legs, and Smoke told him he done broke his knees fishing. Straight to the cat house, the man said. Smoke thought about pulling the strings. He even had his fingers in the little holes and was set to drop oil all the way to the pig-shit northern exit from town. And if he did that, and then passed the cat house, and the law came running to ask why he hadn't stopped like he said he would, Smoke would toss a match and the whole sour town would go up at once. He liked this idea. It was a good idea. A town with so many troughs burning too fast for the buckets. The sound of the storefront splintering, the crack of an entire town square, the crush would be magnificent. He would enjoy watching it burn. The good wood turned to dust, ash in the sky, sailing upward before coming back down like a gray rain. Pieces of the general store settling in the street, bits of the tavern mixed with ashes from the church. Suddenly, Smoke wished for an urn of oil as big as the bat-black sky. He had his fingers in the loops, but his legs told him to rest. They demanded it. Now he stared into the darkness of his room and listened as the hullabaloo diminished below. The sound of the girls gave way to the sound of the women, and the sound of the women gave way to the sound of the glasses being gathered, the doors locked, and the women again, dulcet tones now, reviewing the night they'd had. He leaned forward in the chair and removed his shins, setting them beside the mattress on the floor. Then he lowered himself down. The stubs of his knees throbbed, and the sores on his thighs were hot, then cold. Then he was partially free of the pain. One of the sores had split open, and Smoke touched it and grimaced. He could never quite get rid of the sensation of wearing the legs altogether. Like a man with a hand just cut off, still thinks it's there. Only Smoke felt it double. Old legs, new legs, still there. On his back he could smell the oil, and the oil smelled good. He fell asleep that way, the scent of the oil giving him strange dreams, dreams of himself dripping with it, swimming in it, a full tin man with enough oil in him to burn all the pig-shit towns on the trail. In one dream, he caught up to James Moxie and invited him into a tavern for a drink, and the outlaw went with him, and Smoke gave him a glass full of the good stuff. Moxie thanked him and drank it, and Smoke laughed and told him to open his mouth, and then he tossed a match down the outlaw's throat and red flames came rushing out of Moxie's mouth. But Smoke recoiled when this happened.